We're back. This is Rick Davis.
This is Aaron Edwards.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we help you decide what you think is true and what's not about the most important questions of life. And Aaron, I'm fascinated by the interview so far.
This is pretty great, yeah. It
really is. I think it's a topic that lots of people are interested in.
I think so, too.
It's always fascinated me.
Yeah.
Well, over the break, we decided that Aaron and I would step back a little bit and let these two gentlemen, Gary Habermas and Keith Augustine, talk a little bit more directly to each other. If you've been listening, you know that these are two men, both of whom are experts in the area of near-death experiences. Gary believes that at least some of these are valid experiences and indicative of a life after death, and Keith has the opposing view. So, gentlemen, Keith, why don't you just respond to what Gary was just saying about perhaps you have some more comments about the little girl who drowned or almost drowned and Gary feeling that it was a pretty compelling case. What do you think about that case? And you guys can kind of address each other now.
Okay. Well, first let me say something about the flat EEGs. I'm not claiming that flat EEGs aren't reported. I think a lot of times people say that the EEGs were flat, but in most cases they're not actually being hooked up to the equipment properly that they could even be measured. Like Gerald Worley did a study in which he wrote that, you know, most people who are in a situation where they're being resuscitated aren't really hooked up to the equipment that would be necessary to measure that sort of thing. So I think in some cases people are claimed to have been, you know, under a flat EEG just to make it look more impressive. But the other thing is, I'm not claiming that flat EEGs never happen. I'm just claiming that there's still brain activity going on, even though the EEG doesn't measure it. So I wanted to clarify that.
Well, I guess I wanted to stay out of this, but I have to jump in. If it wasn't measurable, if I understand you correctly, how would you know it was happening?
Well, no, because biologically it's required that once, you know, the brain can't stop and then completely have no brain activity and then start up again.
Well, I definitely do not want to take sides here because that's not my job, but isn't that a little circular? In other words, if you start with the presupposition that the brain can't start again, and then you were to decide that when the equipment that we have won't measure any brain waves, that must not be, if I'm not putting words in your mouth, must not be sensitive enough because you presuppose that the brain must still be functioning. That sounds circular to me. Am I missing something?
Well, no, because it's been established independently, for example, with animal studies, that unless you cool the body down to a certain temperature, you cannot completely stop brain activity and then be able to restore someone to consciousness.
Okay. I get it now.
Brain damage occurs quite quickly, for example.
Got it.
But there has to be some amount of brain activity to restore. You know, it might be a minimum amount of brain activity, but it's not completely no brain activity.
Gary, do you want to take
brain stem?
Do you want to respond to that or take it in a different direction?
Yeah. Well, no, I'd like to respond. I would say, first of all, that I don't think this is debated in medical science, but I'm not trained that way, so I'll just make a comment. I just talked to two of the chief near-death researchers in the last couple of days, and both of them said we have many, many flat EEG cases, and the person's alive and doing well today. Now, one of these guys is a cardiologist, so his patients are up and walking around. He knows what the data is on their charts. He's got that listed there. He's got it in the medical report, and the person's alive. So they come back. Now, I think Keith's point is they could have something down deep, real deep. But, an issue with that for me is if you're almost not functioning, let's say that, you're no heart activity, you've been in that situation. I have a case with no heart and no brain for 25 minutes. Another case, no heart and no brain for 40 minutes. And both people are given a running commentary of what's going on in the room. And they describe things. Now, and by the way, some a distance away. Some in a waiting room a couple floors away to see their relatives. And these things can be checked out. Now, to me, he made the comment, what if the machines were not hooked up properly? And I'm thinking, well, look, these are trained medical personnel, and yeah, it could be a rush situation, but it might not be. Some of these people have these conditions while they are already hooked up. And to say that medical researchers usually mishook up these machines, I think is a huge, huge stretch to say most of them are not hooked up right. So let's say we've got a number of flat EEGs combined with flat EKGs. And let's just say for the sake of the question, could there be some minor brain activity? Because we've got the main stuff covered, and there's nothing there. It's a flat line, as I call it. If I'm reporting something outside the room, down the hall, two doors away, another floor, or in my home, let's say a mile or two away, if I'm reporting those things, it's amazing to me, A, that I'm correctly reporting any verifiable data in the world when I'm almost not alive, if that's where I am. Secondly, if it's reported a distance away, I couldn't see those things, even if I was in the room, totally awake, and doing well. And now, I share with Keith the concern that people can misperceive. But let's say that doesn't make us free criminals, or say there was no car accident or no murder. We have to dig in and do the best we can. I think he and I are both going to agree that we're talking about probability. There's no such thing as proof. We're talking about probability. And in these cases where we have virtually no or no brain activity and no heart activity, and they're reporting things a floor, two floors away, 2 miles away, that they couldn't even do if they were conscious in the room, and they're very, 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 very close to death. By the way, there are some post-death cases.
Hey, Gary, I'm going to pause you for a second so that we can hear from Keith. Keith, I'm sure that the position that you have is not only being just a naysayer, like refuting the positive assertions that people like Gary make, but you must have some positive evidence that this is not true. Did you follow my drift? I mean,
sure, yeah, that's what the hallucinatory cases were. That's why I said they were occasional. I didn't want to say that in every near-death experience case there's going to be a hallucinatory feature, because quite obvious they're not. It's not going to be, every time you have a hallucination, it's not going to be obvious that your experience wasn't real. And I think that near-death experiences are a very particular kind of hallucination. I don't think that they're like other hallucinations in some respects in terms of their pattern, for example.
Keith, how would you hallucinate?
I think they're hallucinatory.
Keith, how would you hallucinate something from a mile away?
Well, see, that's
a proper response.
All right, my point about both.
Make it a floor away in a hospital.
My point about both the flat EEGs, which, by the way, I didn't think were necessarily hooked up improperly. My main point was that in most resuscitations, that people's brainwaves aren't being monitored at all.
That's true.
But the other point was...
You've got to get all of them.
The flat EEG cases, supposedly, and the vertical perception cases, I think those two features are often added to the account to make it sound that much more compelling, that they're not necessarily no brain activity. That's the implication of the flat EEG. You want to give the implication that, oh, this person had an experience when there was no brain activity, therefore it couldn't have been an experience, you know, created by their brain. That's what's trying to be conveyed, but I don't think that...
How would you say it was added to the account when there's a readout of the EEG and so on their medical report? And when coming to, I'm not talking about the 20 years later ones. I'm curious about those too, as I'm sure you are. But when the data are right there in their reports, no flat EEG, flat EKG, and they're reporting things upon coming to, they're correcting people. They're saying this shouldn't be going on in the next room. I know of a case where a guy who had no activity, he was clinically dead. He was resuscitated. First of all, the EMTs could not resuscitate him at the scene. They put him on the ambulance unconscious. He had been unconscious, obviously, for a while before they got there. They took him to the hospital. They resuscitated him at the hospital. And the guy says, hey, I was watching you do all this. And he explained things. Okay, you can say, well, you know, people do those things in rooms sometimes. But he looked at the two EMT guys, and he said, hey, I was watching this from up above. In fact, you know what? I noticed there was a number on top of your ambulance. This is the number. I have two of these cases. Here's the number. Go out and check the number on your ambulance. And the two guys were befuddled. This is not a hookup on an EKG or an EEG. But you know, as you know, there are tests where people put numbers up by the ceiling, and they want to know if people
sure.
have seen these numbers. This guy reported a number on top of the ambulance, but he was laying down, unconscious, clinically dead, when they put him in the ambulance and took him out. They did not resuscitate him until he was in the hospital.
Keith, what do you say to that?
Well, here's what I would say to that. The reason people have done the experimental studies where things are placed in the room, you know, is to basically corroborate those stories. So far, mm-hmm. they haven't been able to do that. But the point is that near-death researchers realize that the stories by themselves, can't constitute hard evidence that people have actually been able to leave their body because the reports could be inaccurate. When you say, you know, for example, they said they saw a number outside the room they couldn't have possibly seen. Well, how do we know, reading that now, that that's what actually happened as opposed to that's the story that eventually got published?
No, I've discussed this with the guy who did the interview, and the two EMTs who knew he was unconscious on the ambulance were just totally befuddled by the guy giving this information for the first time in the hospital where you can't even see the ambulance. Now, I mean, I admit, this guy's not hooked up or anything, but when you kind of implied earlier they can add these things to accounts later, how do you add this when the data are right there on the feed-out of the machines and they report what's going on? I can tell you jokes they tell from people down the hall. How can they report those things right afterwards? How could that be added?
Well, there are two issues. That's one. Embellishment's only one possible answer.
Right.
Another possible answer is that people were able to get the information you mentioned by normal means. For example, hearing conversations take place in the room. Well, presumably, you know, Gary says that someone was basically clinically dead for 45 minutes without having their body temperature cooled. But if they were literally not resuscitated quickly, they wouldn't have been able to come back to life. Because brain damage sets in within 5 minutes.
Nobody in that
room. They weren't really clinically dead. They were. Their brain was working at the time.
Hey, guys, I'm going to have to step in here. We are out of time. However, before we leave, probably each of you is aware of some literature. Perhaps it's online. Perhaps it's a book that you think is particularly compelling that would inform some of our listeners about your viewpoints. Would either one of you like to mention a website or a book or something that would advance your views? Gary?
I'll mention the work of one of the probably four or five biggest names in indie research, a cardiologist named Mike Sabom. Mike wrote about 20 years ago a book that is still hailed as the best medical book on the subject. It's called Recollections of Death, a Medical Investigation, published by Harper & Row. And he came out with a follow-up book just a few years ago called Light and Death.
Okay, Gary, I'm gonna stop you right there.
Sure.
Keith,
sure.
Same thing, same question?
Yeah, I have a paper at www.infidels.org about hallucinatory near-death experiences where I list a variety of cases that exhibit the features that I mentioned before, such as seeing things out of body that aren't really there. And I also take a look at the best, so-called best cases where there is supposed veridical perception, people seeing things that they couldn't possibly see, and find that the evidence actually doesn't support the claim that they were able to do those things.
Okay, well, this is about all the time we have for the show, but thanks so much to both Keith and Gary. You both presented compelling arguments.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, guys. It was very enjoyable.
We'll be back in just a minute. This is Aaron Edwards.
And Rick Davis.
And this is The Things That Matter Most.
We're back. This is Rick Davis.
And this is Aaron Edwards.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we help you decide what you think is true and what's not about the most important questions of life. And we just finished a very interesting interview on a subject that I have always found very interesting, that being the topic of near-death experiences, which obviously also asks the question of whether or not there's life after death.
Absolutely. And, you know, the last time we did a show about near-death experiences, we got a lot of positive feedback. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so Aaron, what did you think about the interview?
Well, I thought it went well, and like I said, I thought that both presented compelling arguments to back up their points of view, but what I think it came down to wasn't only just the validity of near-death experiences, but the accuracy of the evidence. Because Gary and Keith agreed that there is substantial evidence that disproves a lot of these so-called near-death experiences, but the question then becomes, are near-death experiences even possible? Because even if there was only one true near-death experience, that would obviously mean that a near-death experience are at least possible. Don't you agree?
Well, I do, but I would say in any area of inquiry, you can't disprove every incident, right?
Right.
So if that were the standard for proof or disproof, that you had to be able to disprove every incident, then you really couldn't have an opinion on anything.
Well, that's true. That's true.
But I do agree, and I don't think we are talking about a topic where there's only one case.
Right.
I mean, you really are talking about a lot of cases, at least according to Gary, and also according to the reading I've done, there are a lot of cases that are very compelling.
Well, speaking of opinions, what is your opinion on near-death experiences?
Well, personally, you know, I believe in life after death.
Mm-hmm.
And so that opens me up to near-death experiences as a possibility. And there are lots of anecdotes, lots of stories, like the story of Howard Storm.
Right.
And to our listeners, if you want to hear somebody talk about their experience of actually dying and having a hell experience and then a heaven experience, you could go to our website at thethingsthatmattermost.org and listen to the interview with Howard Storm. But I find near-death experiences really very compelling. However, I do believe that as a Christian that it may be easy to kind of get off track, because I think there are a lot. I think everybody on the phone call or on the interview today agreed that there are lots of near-death experiences that aren't valid. And so if a Christian believer were to believe every near-death experience, it would be pretty easy to get off track.
Correct. Yeah, I agree.
Well, and Aaron, what is your experience? What is your opinion about near-death experiences?
Well, I mean, I don't know, because I haven't experienced it firsthand, but I'm also a believer. I'm a Christian, and I do believe that since we are spiritual, that there is a spiritual reality that's outside of our own brain activity. That's the one thing I probably disagree with Keith. But I do believe, I mean, I'm not as well read on the issue as our guests were, but after interviewing Howard Storm, like you said, which our audience can listen to, they can go back and listen to the past shows on thethingsthatmattermost.org, and after reading his book, My Descent into Death, I personally believe that that particular story is true. But again, that's just my opinion, but from all the evidence that I saw that he had gathered, and not to mention the life change that took place before and after was just so remarkable, I do believe that there was an experience that he had that was outside of himself.
Well, I agree. And Aaron, as you know, it just so happened, either providentially or serendipitously, that right after the Howard Storm interview, I happened to be taking a trip up to Cincinnati, which is where Howard lives with my mom, to see some family friends.
And Howard doesn't live with your mom, but yes.
No, thank you for clarifying that. But I actually had a chance to meet Howard Storm and sit down and listen to him talk about his story in person. And yes, on the experience he had, he really ended up giving up everything in his life,
right,
including a very high-paying job, and ultimately, sadly, his wife, who never really could come to accept the gospel that Howard accepted because of his near-death experience.
Call it what you will, it was an experience that changed him. So
exactly. Yeah. That's right. And that was 20 years ago, 25 years ago, so he hasn't recanted the validity of that yet. Well, okay, Aaron, that is kind of the end of the show.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
And thanks for being back, and we will have Lael back with us next week. But to you, our listening audience, let me say this. I know that we all have a busy week coming up, but in the end, it's the answer to the questions we address on this show that may end up determining our eternity. So don't get so busy this week that you don't have time to think about the things that matter most.